You're listening to the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
Yes, do you listen to the Paranormal UK Radio Network, Your Majesty?
Oh yes, most definitely, one has. Well, it'd be a very dull world otherwise, wouldn't it?
UK Radio Network, created by Irene Allen and Mark Johnson. Today, we have Kathleen Marden, a very special guest indeed. Kathleen is MUFON's Director of Experience Research. She is recognised as one of the world's leading pioneers on the ET contact phenomena. Kathleen is also the co-author of many amazing books, most notably Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, co-authored with nuclear physicist Stanton T. Friedman, as well as her acclaimed The Alien Abduction Files with Denise Stoner. Kathleen is also the niece of Betty and Barney Hill, whose UFO abduction experience back in 1961 rocked the world and is one of the most famous UFO cases to date. She has appeared on TV, radio, and authored many articles on the subject. A highly respected and decorated advocate within the field of UFO research.
Kathleen, just want to ask, what actually was it that got you involved within the UFO research? What propelled you into this area?
My interest began when I was 13 years old on the afternoon of September 20, 1961, when my aunt, Betty Hill, phoned my childhood home and spoke to my mother, Janet Miller, who was her sister, about a close encounter that she and my uncle Barney had had in New Hampshire's White Mountains the previous evening. They had been returning home from a brief vacation to Niagara Falls and Canada, were driving through upstate New Hampshire at night. And it was in New Hampshire's White Mountains when they had a very close encounter with a silent hovering disc. My uncle left the car and walked to a field where the disc was just hanging in the sky about 100 feet overhead. And he had conscious continuous recall of observing non-human entities in that disc. It's in all of the early records that I have in my files. Also, there was physical evidence. And this was very interesting to me. So I had the opportunity, as time went on, to meet the scientists who were investigating the case and to observe my aunt and uncle, to question them, to even see the physical evidence that they had that something highly unusual happened to them. And so this sparked my interest in UFOs, and then eventually my interest in ET contact, or if you want to call it alien abduction, is what it was called in that time frame. And so, boy, I grew up. I went to college. I studied psychiatric social work and then graduate work in education. I worked for many years as an educator and education services coordinator. And then in 1988 or so, I decided to leave my profession and to devote my attention to investigating this case for myself, and also to writing a book about my aunt and uncle, who they were and what had happened to them based upon all of the evidence in my aunt's files, my own investigation, and also the hypnosis tapes that my aunt and uncle had over a period of 6 months with a very famous neuropsychiatrist, Dr. Benjamin Simon from Boston, Massachusetts. So that's where my interest started.
Yeah, I mean, I was a kid when I picked up a book. It was by John G. Fuller, The Interrupted Journey. And I do know that there are a lot of inaccuracies with regards to that particular book. And a lot of information had been missing from that. And you had actually co-authored a new book, Captured the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, with the amazing nuclear physicist Stanton T. Friedman. What propelled you to write Captured, Kathleen? What was it that set you and Stanton into this journey of the book?
Well, I had collected so much evidence with regard to my aunt and uncle's case. I was an investigator for the Mutual UFO Network. I trained under MUFON to learn the investigative skills I needed. And I had already written most of that book when I approached Stanton Friedman. The part that was missing was the research on the star map. I did not have a lot of interest in astronomy. My major interest is in social science. So I asked Stanton, the physical scientist who was very involved in the work on the star map, the investigation of this star map that my aunt recalled observing on the craft. So I met with Stanton and I asked him if he would be willing to join me in writing this book and in reviewing my work for accuracy. He ended up driving from his home in New Brunswick, Canada, to my home at the time in Stratham, New Hampshire. And he visited for a few days. He looked at my files. He went home with the manuscript that I had written, and he wrote back to me telling me that he was very interested in working with me because I was taking a scientific approach and because my statements were accurate and not embellished. So that is how this book came mm-hmm. into development as a published work.
Yes, and I know that Kathleen, because you are MUFON's Director of Experience Research, and that really is your area, your forte, as they say. But I remembered one of the incidents within your uncle and aunt's experience that really struck both my twin and myself, and that was when they showed Betty the star map, and she asked, you know, whereabouts were they? And it was something to do with, well, if you don't know where you are, how can I tell you where we are? It just seemed really incredible that this experience that they had, that the beings that had actually come and visited your aunt and uncle seemed very interested in the physiology of us, of our makeup. So What do you think towards that, Kathleen? Your thoughts about what these beings were? Have you come any further in understanding where they were from or anything of that kind?
Well, according to the star map work, which was brilliant work by Marjorie Fish, she was an amateur astronomer, a teacher at the time, but she went on to work at the Oak Ridge Nuclear Laboratory as a research assistant, did the investigation of the star map that Betty had drawn as the result of a post-hypnotic suggestion by Dr. Simon. And so Marjorie worked for many years attempting to identify where these entities were from on this map. And she couldn't find a match until 1971, when a new catalog was released, and she completed her work in 1972 when she finally found a match due to new distance data and due to our discovery of three stars that had not originally been on any star maps. So Betty knew this information, received it in 61, told it to Dr. Simon, and drew the map in 1964. And it was finally determined that these non-human entities probably came from Zeta Reticuli, which was the result of Marjorie's extensive work. Her work was vetted by a number of scientists who stated that her work was accurate. So this was a huge finding. The debunkers didn't like it at all. The disinformants jumped on top of that and started saying, well, you could throw marbles into the sand and come up with a star system. But there were very, very special properties to this map that Betty drew and Marjorie identified.
Wow.
Go ahead.
Sorry, Kathleen, you carry on.
All of the stars on that map were in a plane, meaning that it would be much, much easier for these star travelers to travel from star to star or from solar system to solar system than it would be if this was a constellation that was spread out like raisins in a loaf of raisin bread. Also, those stars, Zeta Reticuli 1 and 2, are stars that are believed to be Earth-like. They have the same elemental composition as the Earth. They are very close to the Earth in terms of warmth and the type of sun that they are. It is believed that they might have planets. We haven't been out there yet. We haven't put our telescopes on there. We're slated to do that within the next few years. So I'm just anxiously awaiting new data and new information to find out if this is indeed even a possibility. But theoretically, the idea that Betty drew this, and it was such a close match to what Marjorie was able to find, ended up being the chance of that happening simply by coincidence would be about 1 in 10,000.
Wow. Ronnie, you were going to ask Kathleen something?
Yes, I've always known when I heard these tapes, Kathleen, when your uncle was disturbed, he was screaming. Now that made my skin crawl, because to hear a respectable grown man terrified is quite chilling. And I do believe that when they examined the visitors, examined Betty and Barney, is it true that they prized Barney's teeth from his mouth, and the examiner went in and tried to do the same on your aunties, and they wouldn't come out? And she said, "What on earth are you doing?" And he was wearing dentures. Is that right?
That's one of the more hilarious elements of what happened on that craft. But yes.
Yes.
They were in separate examining rooms. Betty's examination took place first, and then they went in and examined Barney. Under hypnosis, he recalled feeling what felt like a finger entering his mouth. And, you know, his teeth were then taken out and carried to the next room. The entities opened Betty's mouth and started tugging on her teeth to see if they too were removable, and they were not. She had her natural teeth.
Oh, bless her.
I thought that was fascinating, because they were both traumatized by it, because I know it was very different for them. But although the visitors, it must be made known, they were benevolent, they weren't unkind, they were just different. And am I right in assuming, because I have seen the film they did starring James Earl Jones, I've seen that, and I thought that was a lovely interpretation of it. They actually wore caps, didn't they? The visitors wore caps and uniforms to try and blend in slightly, or look like they were dressed similar to us. Is that right?
Barney noticed a cap on, I believe it was one head, when he was looking up at the craft through binoculars. He wasn't certain that it was a cap, but he thought that it might be from the distance at which he was looking. When they were actually met by these visitors on the ground, there was no cap described. That is, you know, kind of, it's something that I question. I have seen a video of an actual extraterrestrial in a craft, and it is an authenticated video. And in that video, the non-human entity appeared to be wearing a cap of sorts, but when I zeroed in closer, it was like some kind of maybe headset that appeared to be a cap. So I wonder if that's what my uncle saw. I really don't know. But they were dressed in black, shiny uniforms, sort of like body suits, tight fitting.
Yes, and the other thing, Kathleen, that really moved me was, I've must say that my twin and I have looked into this. I mean, we are no experts by any means of the word, but certainly with Betty and Barney Hill, the more that you research, the more you look into their story, the more you feel like an affiliation with them. And I think it's wonderful that you, as their niece, are now, you know, holding the torch for that truth, especially for your auntie, who was Betty, who was very much for that. The other bit that really moved me was when they wanted to give, when Betty was told that she could have a book or something to prove that the experience was real, and there was that kind of like a little bit of a ruckus outside, and when the book was taken from her, and of course, with regards to the evidence, there's so much evidence to state that the event actually did happen, and I've always believed that, even as a kid, reading that book. And who would ever believe that I'd be speaking to the niece of Betty Barney Hill after reading that book from John G. Fuller, and then your captured your amazing book on Betty Barney Hill, a review of the case called Captured. But I know, Kathleen, that your work now with MUFON as Director of Experience Research, you actually help people, don't you, Kathleen, dealing with their experiences. Is that correct?
I do. I head up a team of, it is now 27 people who, on a day-to-day basis, speak with experiencers who complete the experiencer questionnaire at MUFON.com. And if your listeners want to complete that, they should go to MUFON.com, MUFON.com, and scroll down to experiencer research team learn more. Click on that and it will bring up my team, and or part of my team at least. We have to update it. I'm not sure if it's been updated yet. But at the top of that page, you'll see complete the experiencer questionnaire. So people go there. It's a 30-question questionnaire. Some people become discouraged because they think it's a pass or fail test. And the higher the score, the more likely they are. That is absolutely false. It is a test only as an icebreaker, something for the member of my team to talk to this person about. We have non-judgmental listeners who are there to offer their help and assistance. They specialize in ET contact, abduction cases, and they are there to be of assistance. We also have a list of hypnotherapists. We have a list of, and these are vetted professionals. Mm-hmm. And we have also a list of support groups, and some of them are online. I don't, unfortunately, don't think we have one in the UK, but we do have a couple of online groups in the United States.
Wow, that's amazing. I think, you know, from going back to 1961 with your beloved uncle and aunt and what they went through, and now you yourself as their niece are working to try and discover what the phenomena is and where it's coming from. So with regards to your research, Kathleen, have you formulated a conclusion as to whether or not there is one species that's visiting or other species visiting our world? What's your opinion on that?
The evidence is that there are several species visiting. The most prevalent is what we think of as the grays. Those are the ones that my aunt and uncle interacted with. And there are many races of grays visiting. They tend to have the taller, more intelligent ones. And then the small assistants who make sure that you don't get off the craft with anything that belongs to. And so, and they may be intelligent robots. So they may be utilizing technology for these small ones. But all of the experiencers that I have spoken with, and it's well over 1,000, probably going on to a couple of thousand now, after all these years, tell me that these entities seem to be sentient beings. They seem to be just like we are, in a sense. Of course, they're very different. They communicate telepathically, and their body structure is different. But they are just sentient beings. My aunt always used to say, they're people. Can't you understand they're people? Not little waifs floating around their people. And what she meant is that they are sentient beings, even though they're not like us. Some of these beings work with an insectoid, a mantid type being who is very tall. These beings tend to act as physicians on a craft. They're not always working with the grays, but sometimes. Then there are reptilians, and some people have positive experiences with them, and some have not so positive experiences. There are also human types who look just like us, but are more spiritually evolved and can communicate telepathically as well. And then there are several other types, like tall whites, tall goldens, that sort of thing, that are reported but not as frequently as the other types.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And I was going to say, Kathleen, the initial sightings we have, the shapes of the crafts we have here in the UK, are usually they're like orbs or triangular ships. We don't very rarely have the saucer ones. May I ask, what is the common shape, or more or less the common shape people see or report over in your country, the United States? Are they, a lot of them, the triangular ships at all? Or?
Yes, we have reports of triangular craft. We have reports of flying discs, and some of those have cupolas on top, sort of a clear bubble. Some do not. And others are reported as orbs. Now, I have to clarify orbs, because some people see orbs in the distance. Some people see orbs in trees, and some people see orbs inside their homes. So there are different types of orbs. The ones inside the home generally contain ET consciousness and might expand into a full-body non-human entity. So those are different types of orbs that are seen. There is also a very large rectangular kind of craft as well that seems enormous.
Yes. I was just saying to Philip the other day that the orbs that are seen, it does seem remarkably reminiscent to the things that were witnessed through the Second World War, in which they were referred to as Foo Fighters.
Yes.
It seems remarkable because just like Betty and Barney, everything is consistent. When we join the dots and we look back, even they are consistent as well, because when they mentioned these phantom lights, Foo Fighters following jets, these could be them observing the Great War. Do you agree with that, Kathleen?
Yes, I do agree with that.
I also think, Kathleen, I'm very fascinated by what you said with regards to the orbs, energy and consciousness. And, we're all have to think outside the box sometimes. And I totally am on the same page with you with regards to that, that these orbs or these conscious entities perhaps are infiltrating this plane of reality by other means, not necessarily in our way of interpreting ships. Perhaps they found some form of quantum technology or something that we're still looking into with regards to science. But I know that I've been in touch with Earl Grey, and he obviously is on board with the MUFON, because Earl said that you are his boss.
Yes.
And he has a lot of total respect for you, as everyone else that I know does. And he referred to something that you had mentioned and kind of like fascinated me, because you had mentioned rogue greys. And I have to state, in a professional way, I had to chuckle, because like humans, we have good people, we have bad people. I suppose with the greys, you have the good and the bad. But could you explain a little bit, Kathleen, on your prognosis of what the rogue greys are? I think that would be interesting for people to hear that.
Well, it took a great deal of research on my part, but I attempted to understand why some of these, or most of these greys, appeared to be scientists just doing a job. They were businesslike, and even some were benevolent, whereas others seem to be uncaring. And the more I did research, the more experiencers and people who are highly knowledgeable in this field that I spoke with, the more I came to realize that there is a group of rogue greys who do have a bad reputation. They might have been captured by these negative reptilians. And I know a lot of this sounds like science fiction. It's hard to grasp, especially when you're a nuts and bolts kind of person and haven't been studying this for a very long period of time. I like to say the more you know about this topic, the crazier you sound to those who don't know much about it.
I think, Kathleen, yes, definitely. Sorry to interrupt you, Kathleen. I totally agree with you, because when you first initially become interested in the UFO subject, we are normally look at it as a nuts and bolts aspect. And I have to agree with you totally that the more that you get involved, and, you know, science fiction becomes science fact, but I think it's a generalized acceptance within the psyche that when you start to sink with the experience, when you start to grow with the experience itself, I believe, molds your mind into an understanding that goes beyond the physical. And of course, this brings in a whole host of other areas of unexplained phenomena, and it may lead us to that point where we are able to understand it much more. But I think your research is absolutely incredible. And I think with regards to your books, equally so. You also wrote a book with Denise Stoner, The Alien Abduction Files. May I ask, please, Kathleen, what was it that propelled you then to write this book? Because I assume this is the case files from the work you've been doing. Is that correct?
Yes, it is six fairly outstanding cases that I had personally investigated. I am a hypnotherapist, and I very rarely use it, but if I find two people or more than two people who are in a family who are having the same experience and have conscious recall and evidence, that is when I will utilize hypnosis. I've studied Betty's and Barney's hypnosis tapes. I've studied under Bud Hopkins a little bit, and with various hypnotherapists who work with experiencers. And I used that on two of the cases that I wrote about in the alien abduction files. The first case is that of Denise and Ed Stoner, who were a highly respected, well-respected couple, had responsible jobs, a responsible place in the community, and were driving through a valley in Colorado, the South Park Valley, on a weekend trip. This was in the summer, August 13, 1982, just driving through South Park Valley to go to their summer home. And this summer home was on a ranch in Buena Vista. And they would meet Denise's parents, who would have dinner ready for them every Friday night in the summer. And so on this particular night, Ed and Denise had come off a 10,000-foot pass, and they were descending the pass when they saw these two lights coming very rapidly in. And as they descended the pass and went down through by a little town just at the foot of the pass, those lights came toward their car very rapidly. And they felt their car lift off the highway over a snow fence and be carried out into the desert. The next thing they knew, now this was daylight when this happened, the next thing they knew, they were on Trout Creek Pass 40 miles away with no memory of what had happened in the interim. It was pitch black outside. They were cold, their vehicle wasn't running, and they were sitting there wondering what was going on. So we had to open up all of the mystery of what they both experienced. So I hypnotized them separately. During my investigation, I went to Colorado, I investigated where this occurred, and many other experiences that they had had, and particularly that Denise has had. And she wrote about her impression of what had occurred, and I wrote about my investigation of this from a scientific point of view.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's incredible. I think, to be honest with you, that with any experience that people have, it comes with a level of high strangeness, most certainly. And you know, individual cases are very highly complex and sometimes a little bit disturbing. But I think when we get to the root of what's been going on, you kind of like heal with the experience. You know, if someone's had a traumatic experience, in time, I believe that this opens up new areas within consciousness, new areas within the mind, and maybe our understanding of that fear we have to work on, because it may not be as fearful as what it was meant to be. You understand, Kathleen, what I mean there.
Absolutely.
Sorry.
I was just going to say, as people gain an understanding of their own experiences and of what is going on overall, they tend to lose their fear and gain a greater understanding, because this may seem like high strangeness, but if you take a look at theoretical physics, one day it's going to be the norm. As we begin to understand the interdimensional aspect of science.
Wow. Yes. Ronnie?
Yes, that's quite true. I mean, I happened to be witness, Kathleen, some years ago. I had a witness with me. He was an 88 or 89-year-old atheist, and he didn't believe in UFOs. And we were outside one night, and these seven UFOs appeared out of thin air. They were so low. They were massive. They were the size of the moon. There were seven of them. There were two, 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 and then one tailing them behind, central. Now, when you said about interdimensional, I mean, it was quite scary. I don't know what they were, but they were unnatural completely. They weren't ball lightning or atmospheric distortions, but the old boy, it changed his views completely. I think we were both meant to see that. I had seen things prior to that anyway, but when you said interdimensional, well, I said they came out of thin air, but I realized that they seemed to be, or must have been, opening a pocket of air, or it's coming, slipping through a dimension. And the interesting thing is, I have a police officer friend, and the very next day she saw these seven things just hanging in the sky. So when you said about the interdimensional aspect, I like that, because scientists are now confirming the fact that dimensions are quite true. They are real, interdimensional especially.
And it appears that this is the type of understanding that they have, where they can use technology, even if they are 39 light years away, to come here fairly rapidly.
Yes.
But it does appear that once they have arrived, they stay around for a while. They're seen coming in and out of our oceans, and yes. Many people believed that they are hiding under our oceans, out of sight.
Yes. Kathleen, may I ask, you've probably been asked this many, many times before, but and I hope you don't raise your eyebrows at it, but what are your views of the Roswell crash that happened in 1947? Because we don't know, we're none the wiser. What are your own thoughts on that? Do you think it could have happened or not?
Well, I wrote about the Roswell crash in my book with Stanton Friedman, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers. And I do speak at the Roswell UFO Festival each year, so I have the opportunity to speak with and listen to all of those people who specialize in Roswell, and Stanton is one of them. I have seen evidence that leads me to believe that the Roswell crash was a real event.
Yes.
I know from my research, and I wrote about this in Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers, that our federal government did an extensive analysis of the evidence concerning UFOs, or flying discs, they called them back in that time. And they wanted to know, what are these things? Are they real? Why are there around our nuclear weapons sites, and are they from? Are they being manufactured by our enemy or not? And in 1947, they released a secret report. It was classified at the time, but it's no longer classified, and it's in our book. But it basically states that these craft appear not to be of this earth, that they appear to be, have the capability of outflying and outmaneuvering anything that we have. They appear to be solid, metallic, structured craft. And so we know this based upon
yes.
The evidence that they had in this time frame. They do not mention evidence of a downed craft. And the reason that they couldn't mention that is because evidence of a downed craft would have to be classified above top secret code word. And access to those files is only available on a need-to-know basis to individuals who have have access to that type of classified information. That's yeah. how our classification system works here in the United States. Yeah. So it could not be mentioned in that document that is available to our public now.
Yes, I have to say that I had to laugh when people, you get the ignorant, you always do, Kathleen, when they say, well, how could advanced aliens crash their ships? Well, unfortunately, accidents do happen. And I have to remind them that our own experienced pilots in not only aircraft, but spacecraft do sometimes have accidents, you see. So, and also your interesting suggestion of perhaps some of them being robots manufactured, I like that, from the masters. It could be possible that it would make absolute sense, do you agree, that they would manufacture workers to observe us while they are safely on board their ships or wherever they are, to use them as their eyes and ears. You know, when you said that they can change direction so swiftly because the G-forces effect would kill us instantly, but with them, yes. if they were manufactured, your own suggestion, which is amazing, that would actually clarify that point. If they were synthetic, I'll use that word, because if they're so advanced, of course they'll be able to manufacture their version of robots, or as we would call synthetic. So yes, I wonder if the crew on board that craft, and I always believed it did happen because there's no smoke without fire, is that they could possibly have been synthetic, biological. We're talking about synthetic, biological. You understand what I mean, Kathleen?
Yes, absolutely.
And also, Kathleen, the other thing is that with regards to your research, with regards to experience research that you do, one of the things that I found myself, and I know this sounds strange because I'm one of many, many individuals. I mean, we're not there to, you know, claim anything, but try to understand certain things that have happened to us. But one of the things that an experience that I had, a major one back in 1989, has taught me is that it seems to give me a greater understanding, perhaps, of our place here and of the survival of human consciousness beyond this realm. Because I think when you're taking out of the norm, it's like when an abduction occurs. Let's call it an abduction, if that's the correct word to use. And you normally, most people find themselves out of time, out of space, and perhaps these entities are so advanced that they literally are taking you outside the matrix, or the matrix that we exist in, and that consciousness, because it's taking outside of its normal processing of conscious awareness, it forgets, or sometimes it isn't able to recall what's happened. Is there a case, sorry, that you've done that's really, really affected you or stood out, Kathleen, with regards to your research, not just with regards to your lovely uncle and aunt, Betty and Barney Hill? Has there been a case that's really stood out to you as, like, really incredible?
Well, there are the cases that I wrote about in the Alien Abduction Files.
Yes.
Gosh, I have... let me talk about Jenny Henderson, because that is when I started to talk to theoretical physicists about the question of how these extraterrestrials are able to pass through solid surfaces, mm-hmm. into an experiencer's home without going through the door, seemingly going through a window that is closed, and how it is possible to move the human body out from wherever it is inside a closed structure onto a craft. And for many years, when I was simply dedicated to being a physical scientist on this and examining physical evidence, I had to think that it probably wasn't happening that way. But then Jenny Henderson was a highly credible individual, and I had to start asking questions. How is this possible? This was a generational abduction. And the theoretical physicist that I talked to said to me that theoretically, all matter vibrates at a certain frequency. Mm-hmm. So it would be a matter of aligning the human body's frequency to the frequency of that wall, that inanimate object, and probably the frequency of those the bodies of those non-human entities, for atoms to interpenetrate. And they said, remember, 99.9% of the atom is empty space.
Correct.
So we have to understand that it is theoretically possible to do this. And in fact, we have already done this on an extremely small scale using neutrinos in a laboratory, you know, it's setting. So we have confirmed that it is possible. We simply don't have the knowledge and technology now. We're sort of like, you know, the caveman level compared to the of technology and understanding.
Well, I've got to give you a lot more credit, Kathleen, than that, because your research is far more advanced than a caveman. But I understand where you're coming from with regards to that. Have you yourself, Kathleen, experienced or seen a UFO at all? Have you ever had some experiences yourself?
Yes, and I wrote about this in Captured, but I couldn't use my name because I was writing in the third person. But I wrote about an experience near my childhood home. It happened in 1966, February of 1966, where my family and a family friend and I saw a UFO up close. We followed it to a lake near my childhood home. We watched it as it rose up from above the ice. We followed it again. And as we were looking for it, some of us were looking in one direction from a bridge, the other in the other direction. My mother was the one who spotted these two crafts that were hovering just over the ice. And one of those projected a bluish beam of light on my mother. And she said it wasn't like a regular light beam where you sort of turn a flashlight on or turn it off. This came toward her in a measured way. She then yelled, screamed, said, quick, to everybody, get into the car, we have to get out of here. And so that was one experience I had. I also had an experience where in April of that same year, my aunt was doing contact experiments with a group of scientists attempting to call in UFOs to land on my grandparents' farm. Well, I didn't know that this was happening. It was a big secret in that time frame. They weren't telling anybody. But a UFO did come in and land on my grandparents' farm. I grew up across the street from their farm. My house was in within 250 feet of where that craft landed. It was observed by two separate individuals, and it left physical trace evidence on the ground.
Wow. I mean, that is incredible. It appears to me, Kathleen, that, you know, looking at your uncle and aunt and with your family, with regards to your family, I did read that, but a lot of the listeners would not be aware of that, is that I believe that with yourself, that yours is also, your contacts are linked with family and family generations. So I believe that it's linked with all of you. And that much, I suppose, you know, you're probably aware of that also. Have you had any experiences with the Greys, as it were, at all?
I have just begun to speak of this, but yes, I do believe that I have, and I do know that it's generational. Dr. Don C. Dondari, a psychology professor and statistician from McGill University, and I completed a major comprehensive study for the Mutual UFO Network over a three-year period. And what we discovered is that the majority of experiencers tend to have generational or intergenerational contact. So it appears to be passed down. It appears to be a longitudinal genetic study. They have even stated that what they are attempting to do is to raise human consciousness for one thing, and also to move us ahead on an evolutionary scale in our genetic makeup, so that we will be able to one day move into a kindergartner's position in the cosmic universe, you might say.
Yes.
Where we can communicate, where we can learn more. But given our hostility and our propensity for warlike behavior, they have great concern over us, over our use of nuclear weapons, over our failure to be good stewards to our planet's environment. So they have many concerns, and they do not want to interact with many humans until we reach certain standards where they will be able to welcome us.
Yes, Kathleen, you said about waiting for us to advance. I do sometimes wonder if the Roswell ship that crashed could even have been deliberate to spearhead the electronic age. And who knows, they may have unlocked some of those secrets. I mean, we've made such an incredible jump in the past century, an incredible jump with technology. And it just sometimes surprises me that, or I sometimes wonder that it could possibly be attributed to that crashed ship of what they discovered in it, because that is strange how after that the electronic era boomed, didn't it? It took a while, but it boomed.
Yes, and several researchers have speculated that it was an intentional crash in order to pass technology to us. And the United States is not the only place where this has happened. We know that the former Soviet Union also had a crash there. And so we've sort of always been in competition with the Soviets in terms of our technological development, one moving ahead, then the other moving ahead. So they have, in fact, the non-human entities have, in fact, given information dating back into the mid-50s to a person who was in contact with these non-human entities and was also secretly cooperating with the government of the United States and the government of Canada. And they stated that they, if they share technology, it will be shared with everyone, and one country will not have an advantage over another. So no preference will be shown to any country in particular. I wrote about this, in fact, in Free's new book. This is the Edgar Mitchell Foundation for Research into Extraterrestrial Encounters, and it's titled Beyond UFOs, The Science of Contact and Conscious Communication. And so I have a chapter in that book. I'm on their board of directors and have also cooperated with them in working on a study of experiencers. So I myself work with individuals who ask for my help, or organizations, and both MUFON and Free asked for my help. I was willing to help them.
Wow. With regards to the Edgar Cayce Foundation, Kathleen, I'm right on board there with you. I've got the same ideas about life after death, about the elevation of consciousness, the same with my twin brother, being good people, trying to reach out with regards to these other entities. And I will tell you that we had performed an experiment many years ago that seemed to work, and that's another story with regards to trying to bring a UFO to us that did happen. But I really am so intrigued and full of respect for you, Kathleen, with regards to the work that you've done, because, you know, it's really such such a small world. John G. Fuller, who wrote the original book, Interrupted Journey, and then he wrote The Ghost of 29 Megacycles, and then he wrote The Airman Who Would Not Die. And we are not that far away from Cardington Hangars, where the R101 took its maiden voyage, which is a dirigible airship, and crashed. And there was a whole ghost story linked to that. So it really is a very small world when you think about everyone's interconnection with one another. Where are you going with your work, Kathy? Where do you see yourself moving with this work of yours?
I'm attempting to figure that out right now. I have to tell you that I am preparing to speak at conferences this year. I speak quite frequently. And you can go to my website at Kathleen, with a K, dash Marden, MARDEN.com. And you can read about where I'm going to be speaking this year. There's a fantastic cruise coming up from October 6th through the 13th, leaving from San Diego, California, and going to Mexico, to Mazatlan, and Cabo San Lucas and Puerto Vallarta, with seminars going on the ship with the leading UFO researchers today. So I'm very excited about that. I'm also working on quantum healing hypnosis, that technique. I've completed my level one training to add to my repertoire as a hypnotist. I'm taking level two training this spring. So I'm working on that. I'm continuing with my work with Mutual UFO Network and also with Free. So that will keep me busy as well. So I think I have an exciting year coming up again. I managed to stay busy all of the time.
That is wonderful. I know we're coming up to the end of the show, and I just want to tell all our listeners that both Ronald and I are very honoured to have you come on board and to speak about your marvellous work as director of MUFON and experience research, the books that you've written, the theoretical applications that you're bringing forward to not only to help people understand their UFO experiences, but also the science behind that. And I know also both Ronald and I know that you've been linked with some very, very famous and very incredible scientists and people in the world. And we wish you the very best of luck, Kathleen, with moving forward in your work. I only wish, dear Lord, that if time permitted, that we could have met your wonderful uncle and auntie, who my brother and I have the greatest of respect for.
They were wonderful people, and I'm really honored to carry on with their work.
Yes. Ronnie?
Thank you, Kathleen. It's been an absolute honor and pleasure. And may I just say that we wish you the very best of luck in your pursuit of what you're doing, and we would love to have you on perhaps sometime, some point in the future. We will be honored to have you again.
And thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be on with you, and I'd be happy to come back.
Thank you. And you've been listening to Twin Souls Radio in association with the Paranormal UK Radio Network. The amazing and incredible Kathleen Marden, a highly respected and decorated advocate within the field of UFO research. Thank you very much. And it's a good night from us all. Good night.